Okay, let's get started. We are picking up in the book of Nehemiah. Last week, or the class we had last, we talked about the book of Ezra for a couple of weeks. I think it was six classes total. The main gist of it to know before you go into the book of Nehemiah is the fact that you have the threat from God to the Israelites through all the prophets for generations, that if they did not return to the law of God, if they weren't returning to their faithfulness, then there was going to be an empire that would rise and would take them away to captivity. You have Israel separated from the north and the south, so two different countries, essentially. The north is taken away by Assyria, and then the south is spared for a couple of generations when Hezekiah is king. And then you have the south eventually falling as well, and they're taken away not by Assyria, but by the people that took over Assyria, the Babylonians. So the Babylonians take away a large amount of people into captivity, away from the homeland, into Babylonia. And then a couple generations go by, 70 years technically. And so when you look at the history, you learn that the Medo-Persian Empire, the first king of that is called Cyrus, and he took over Babylonia, who took over Assyria, and he is allowed by God to send back people to the land of Jerusalem to rebuild the temple, to rebuild the city walls, and to establish that for the coming of the Messiah. That's the big deal, is if they don't restore Jerusalem, then the Messiah can't be born the way that he's supposed to, the prophecies can't be fulfilled, and that's the way things are going. So the book of Ezra is showing you the first two waves of Israelites that chose to come back from Babylonian captivity when it was the Medo-Persian Empire captivity at that point. And then they have gone so far and rebuilt Jerusalem, the city that is there, and the surrounding areas. There are now villages and towns that have been rebuilt. You have the temple foundation was laid, and then they ran into some issues that caused them to slow down. Some adversaries were in the land, and so after the preaching of two prophets, they get back to work, and long story short, they finish the temple. They dedicate the temple once again. The Levitical priesthood is there with all their servants, and they're allowed to offer animal sacrifices again and to hold the feast days or the holy days in Jerusalem once again. And then Ezra comes with the second wave of Israelites. That was the first wave. The second wave happens, and Ezra realizes he is a Levite. He is should be a priest. He's a scribe, so he knows the law of Moses very well. And then he realizes that we have people that are living as Israelites who have intermarried with the people of the land. And that was the issue all the way back in the book of Joshua. If you can connect those two dots, then you realize that if they never would have intermarried with the people of the land of Canaan to begin with, then they wouldn't have the problem of idolatry that led them to the issue of being taken away captive. So Ezra, he's wearing sackcloth and ashes, he's fasting, he's praying for forgiveness for the people, and kind of long story short, they get out of those marriages, they disavow those marriages to people from the land of Canaan to avoid that sin, which was a sin for the Israelites. So let's jump back to the book of Nehemiah once again, and I want to read the introduction from the ESV again to kind of remind us of where we are. So Nehemiah, ESV introduction. In 445 BC, the Persian king Artaxerxes sent Nehemiah, an Israelite who was a trusted official, to help rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. So if you're looking for what this book's all about, you have Ezra, and that book is talking about rebuilding the temple, and Nehemiah is all about rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. Why is that so important? It's important because if you have a city that's built on a hill that has high walls, it's hard to attack them and be successful. There were other people who tried to attack Israelite when they were built upon Mount Zion, and they really couldn't because you have to fight your way uphill and then overcome the walls to take the city. And so if they rebuild the walls again, it'll be more secure for the future, is the idea. There was intense opposition from the other people in the land and disunity within Jerusalem. Despite this opposition, Nehemiah rebuilt the walls. He overcame these threats by taking wise defensive measures, by personal example, and by his obvious courage. Nehemiah did what God had put into his heart and found that the joy of the Lord was his strength. When the people began once again to fall into sin, Nehemiah had Ezra read to them from the law. Nehemiah served twice as governor. The author is unknown, although parts from Nehemiah's own writing. So what we're looking at here is basically an introduction to Nehemiah. Something I learned this week, which I did not know before, which kind of shows you, obviously, you never stop learning new things. I did not know that when the Jews, or people that are Jewish, look at their Bibles, their Hebrew Bibles, they combine Ezra and Nehemiah. So you might know that they combine 1 and 2 Samuel as the book of Samuel or the scroll of Samuel. You might know that they combine 1 and 2 Chronicles to be the book of Chronicles. You might know 1 and 2 Kings is called the book of Kings. And even some Bibles calls the first book of Kings what we call Samuel. So anyway, they combine some books into one large scroll, and they combine Ezra and Nehemiah into one book. It is called the Book of Ezra, and it includes what we would call Ezra and Nehemiah. So there's a little bit of maybe redundancy and a little bit of kind of overlap there, but just interesting little piece of information I learned from class that I'm in this week. So there you go. Okay, chapter 1, verse 1. So this begins in our versions as a new book. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hilkiah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the citadel. So that's the capital city of the Medo-Persian Empire, Susa, or Shushan is called somewhere else. Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. So they were just talking about the folks that made it through the captivity. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. So the once great city of Jerusalem is not so great anymore. It's been abandoned for 70 years while they're away in captivity. The temple's reestablished, and that's great, but as a city, it's still, as the city of God for the Israelites, not what it used to be. So verse 4, as soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenants and steadfast love with those that love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel which have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. So he is reminded of what the law says about what would happen if they abandoned God. Verse 10, they are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. Verse 11, O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name and give success to your servants today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. And then you have him breaking here from the prayer to say this, now I was cupbearer to the king. And so you kind of have an idea of who Nehemiah is here. He's not some great priest. He's not some great prophet, really. He's just a guy who's found himself in a place of acquaintance with the ruler of the Medo-Persian Empire. He's a cupbearer. So, I mean, I think of traditionally the role of a cupbearer was to bear or to carry the royal cup from which he would drink. I think more in medieval times, the cupbearer is thought of being someone who would first taste the wine before the king to either prove it's, you know, it's how refined it is, or to make sure it's not poisoned. I'm not sure if it dates back to this ancient time of being that being the role, but it's a place of being a slave or a servant to the king. So that's the idea. Chapter 2, verse 1. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." And then I was very much afraid. So it seems like the author here is referring to Nehemiah as himself. And so it would kind of beg the idea that the author of this text is Nehemiah himself. Verse 3, I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What are you requesting?" And so I prayed to the God of heaven. I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will you be gone, and when will you return?" And so it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And so, you know, he's in a position here to where obviously the king cares about him enough to be concerned about his well-being and his emotional state. And so, you know, he's got an opportunity here to go do some good work. And I said to the king, verse 7, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of the province beyond the river, the Tigris and Euphrates," the Euphrates being the one here, "that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall occupy." And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. So he's grateful for the opportunity to go and do something about the sad news he heard about the walls. And he used his relationship with the king to kind of leverage that advantage for God's purposes. And, you know, he sees it as God's blessing, which is the appropriate way, you know, God-fearers think about these opportunities. Verse 9. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king has sent me with officers of the army and horsemen, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servants heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So here is the enemies in this book, right? It was the people that were would become the Samaritans to the 2nd and 3rd century BC. But here it's Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite. Now the Ammonites from Ammon, they were there way before Israel was, but they were still around, obviously. Kind of commenting on that, the obvious thing to say would be that when God sent them into the land of Canaan, and there were the Ammonites there, before the Jordan River, they were told to kill all of them and to wipe them all out. And so you kind of reflect on that for a minute and not discussing the fact that God's saying to go kill them, but just the very, you know, practical, logical principle that if they would have killed all the Ammonites there, the issue would not be here for them to have to address with Tobiah the Ammonite, right? So that's, you know, a continuation of the sins of the previous generations affecting the current generation. The same thing happens to us, right? Sin not only affects us physically and spiritually, but also it can ripple into the future as well, right? Okay, verse 11. So I went to Jerusalem and was there for 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, And I told no one what God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. So there's that phrase that we see so commonly used today, maybe even flippantly or without regard to the actual meaning of what's being said. God laid something on my heart or put something on my heart. A whole lot about that conversation that we could say, but I'll just simply say that what Nehemiah is doing here is what God inspired him to do in a, probably a literal way, meaning he's under the direct operation of God, not just something that he wanted to do and he's going to ascribe to God later. So there you go. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode, probably a donkey or a camel. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, which you can imagine what the dung gate would use for. This was the sewer portion of Jerusalem. And I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that they were broken down, and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. And then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. So he's doing a visual inspection of the actual walls of Jerusalem. If you look at a study Bible, or if you have a Bible atlas, which is sometimes helpful, they will have sometimes in these different sections kind of a map of what Jerusalem looked like. And that changes over the books that we're discussing, right? So at the very beginning of David's reign, Jerusalem was kind of small. It had this kind of the temple and the king's house and the kind of town that was around it. And then it expanded even further, and he had more land around there. And then it keeps going and going to where it is now. Every single square foot is used when it comes to the city of Jerusalem. So if you have a study Bible or an atlas that you like to use, or you can just Google this, I'm sure, you can look at what the city of Jerusalem's walls look like in the book of Nehemiah, and you can kind of follow what he's saying here visually, if that would be helpful to you at all. So anyway, verse 15. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and entered by the valley gate, and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. And I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. So he's kind of there as a contractor, right? And he's going to subcontract this work out to the people that are already there because they're the ones doing the work. But that was his intention, was by God's influence, it seems to be from the text, that he is going to rebuild the walls. And it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be, everyone's going to be happy about that in the area, but that's the work that he's going to do, and thus the book of Nehemiah. Verse 17, and then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. So folks are talking bad about Israel, which shouldn't be the case if they're the people of God, the one and true living only God, right? So we have him saying people are mocking us because we're living in this ruined out, destroyed city, and this is the city of God. They're not going to respect God if the city is in disrepair, right? So, verse 18, I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also the words that the king has spoken to me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. And when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? So here we have the point of friction. You got these people that are kind of ruling in the land, and they know that Israel's been beaten up for 70 years, and now they don't want Israel to once again reach the heights of where they were before. And so their mode of attack is going to be what happened in the book of Ezra. They're going to claim that they don't have the authorization from the emperor or from the king to do what they're doing, and they're going to cause all kinds of problems. So that's going to be the spoiler for you for the rest of the book. Verse 20. Then I replied to them, The God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. Verse 1 of chapter 3. Then Eliashib the high priest rose up with his brothers, the priest, and they built the sheep gate, which you can imagine was used likely for sheep. The sheep here wouldn't be just shepherding sheep. They would be sacrificial sheep led to the priesthood. They consecrated it and set its doors. They consecrated it as far as the Tower of the Hundred, as far as the Tower of Hananel. And next to him, the men of Jericho built. And next to them, Zachur, the son of Imri, built. The sons of Hassanah built the fish gate, I suppose where fish was brought in. They laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And next to them, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, son of Hakoz, repaired. And next to them, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabel, repaired. Next to them, Zadok, the son of Bana, repaired. So you kind of get the idea here that they're now all taking up the work, and he is lying out for you who is doing what and into what area. So they're all working together is the concept. And next to them, the Tekoites repaired, and their nobles would not stoop to serve their lord. So you got this kind of servant class of this group in verse 5 serving, but he kind of calls them out and says, but the nobles that came, they were too good to do the work. This reminds me of one lesson that was taught to us in preaching school. And it's very simplistic. I mean, it's nothing that it would surprise any of you, but I think one of the instructors says, just make sure that you don't think you're too good to do the work. And what he meant by that was sometimes, you know, it can be a temptation for the preacher or the minister to kind of think that, you know, our job is visiting and writing sermons and studying and evangelizing, but when it comes to painting or repairing or cleaning or sweeping or cutting the grass or whatever needs to be done, just make sure you're not too good for that, which is, you know, if Christ is not too good to wash his, you know, his followers' feet, that should be a pretty good lesson, right? So anyway, the book that Nehemiah calls out that they were too good kind of is an important thing. Okay, verse 6. Joiada, the son of Pesha, and Meshulam, the son of Bezadiah, repaired the gates of Yeshana. They laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And next to them repaired Malatiah, the Gibeonite, and Jadon, the Maranothite, the men of Gibeah and of Mizpah, the seat of the governor of the province beyond the river. Next to them, Uzel, the son of Harhiah, goldsmiths repaired. Next to him, Hananiah, one of the perfumers, repaired, and they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Next to them, Raphaiah, the son of Hur, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired. Next to them, Jedidiah, the son of Harumaph, repaired opposite his house. And next to him, Hattush, the son of Hashbaniah, repaired. Malchijai, the son of Harim and Hashbub, verse 11. The son of Pahath Moab repaired another section of the Tower of the Ovens. Next to him, Shalom, the son of Halohesh, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired he and his daughters. So again, this gives you the concept here that for the most part, they're all doing their part to get the work done. It's not just one group of people doing it. They're all taking up their portion, right? Verse 13, Hanan, the son of Zanoah, repaired the valley gate. They rebuilt it and set its doors, its bolts, its bars, and repaired 1,000 cubits of the wall as far as the dung gate or the sewer section of Jerusalem. Because it's got to go somewhere, right? Malchijah, the son of Rechab, the ruler of the district of Beth, which means house of Hakarim, repaired the dung gate. He rebuilt it and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And Shalom, the son of Kol-Hazes, ruler of the district of Mizpah, repaired the fountain gate. He rebuilt it and covered it and set its doors, its bolts, its bars. He rebuilt the wall, the pool of Shiloah, of the king's garden, as far as the stairs that go down from the city of David, or Jerusalem. After him, Nehemiah, the son of Azbuk, ruler of half the district of Beth-Zur, repaired the point opposite the tombs of David, as far as the artificial pool, as far as the house of the mighty man. So there was a section that was dedicated to the mighty men of valor, or I don't know, the special forces, I sometimes say, of the Old Testament, the folks of renown, right? After him, the Levites repaired, Rehum, the son of Bani. Next to him, Hashabiah, ruler of half the district of Keilah, repaired for his district. After him, their brothers repaired, Bobby, the son of Henadad, ruler of half the district of Keilah. Next to him, Ezer, the son of Jeshua, ruler of Mizpah, repaired another section opposite the ascent to the armory at the buttress. After him, Baruch, the son of Zabai, repaired another section from the buttress to the door, the house of Eliashib, the high priest. After him, Meramoth, the son of Uriah, son of Hakkaz, repaired another section from the door of the house of Eliashib to the end of the house of Eliashib. After him, the priests, the men of the surrounding area, repaired. After them, Benjamin and Hashbub repaired opposite their house. After them, Azariah, the son of Masiah, son of Ananiah, repaired beside his own house. After him, Binui, the son of Henadad, repaired another section from the house of Azariah to the buttress and to the corner. Palal, the son of Uzai, repaired opposite the buttress and the tower projecting from the upper house of the king at the court of the guard. After him, Bedadiah, the son of Parosh, and the temple servants living on Ophel, repaired a point opposite to the water gate on the east in the projecting tower. After him, the Tekoites repaired another section opposite the great projecting tower as far as the wall of Ophel, above the horse gate, where the horses were. The priests repaired each one opposite his own house. After them, Zadok, the son of Immer, repaired opposite his own house. After him, Shemaiah, the son of Shechaniah, the keeper of the east gate, repaired. After him, Hananiah, the son of Shelemiah, and Hanun, the sixth son of Zalaph, repaired another section. After him, Meshulam, the son of Bechariah, repaired opposite his chamber. After him, Malchijai, one of the goldsmiths, repaired as far as the house of the temple servants and of the merchants, opposite the muster gate to the upper chamber of the corner. And between the upper chamber of the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmith and the merchants repaired. So that's the end of chapter 3. So you can kind of get why it's so difficult to talk about these books in a Bible class setting, right? I mean, those names are no fun to read, but I think it's important to kind of step back just for a minute and remember why those names are there. First and foremost, this is a history book. And so what we're reading here is a historical account written near the time of these events taking place, probably here by the man Nehemiah. And he is giving the names and the family lineage of the people that are putting the work in. That's important to know. So it's not just a parable or a story or an allegory or a metaphor or a good moral story. It's not that. This is what happened. Here's who did the work. Here's where they worked. This is what they did. And so it's history. That's important to note first and foremost. Second of all, you get to kind of get a flavor of how many people are involved in this work to rebuild the city of Jerusalem because it was important to them, because it was important to God. So they are willing to do this work to improve the city of God, to bring about his blessing, to bring about the Messiah, to bring about salvation for all mankind. And if they didn't all pitch together in this way, I mean, ultimately, big picture, we wouldn't have the Savior the way that we do. I mean, I remember that in the gospel accounts, we read about, you know, all the disciples and Jesus going through and looking at the temple and seeing how beautiful it is. They're saying this is like the most beautiful house in the world. And he says, yeah, but I tell you truly, you know, there's going to be a day coming where there's not going to be one brick on top of another brick when it's going to be destroyed again. It's not about the temple. right? But it was there to be a reminder. We have them having the Day of Atonement, you know, up until that point, the ultimate physical representation of what the Messiah would be for us. He is going to be our atonement. He will be that lamb that's led before the sacrificer and be sacrificed for our sins. We have him going through and up to Jerusalem, the triumphant entry. We read about him being presented as the Messiah, the Christ, in that account. So if it's not done here, we wouldn't have any of that, really. That's the whole point. And also, on a side note, there's credit here, right? We have these people by name, by family of origin, and what they did, they're given credit. And so when it comes to us serving, even in simplistic ways, a lot of times we want to kind of shrug off any kind of credit that may be due to us or recognition. It's hard not to be recognized when the book is in the book sent from God. These guys' names are in that. And so it's kind of an encouragement to us that we don't have to suffer in silence without recognition. It's not all about that, obviously, but it's nice to be recognized for the work that you put in. And there are people that I know in this congregation who would hate to have their names mentioned as being people that work silently but hard behind the scenes to make what we have that works in this congregation work so well. I'm not going to mention their names. But they should be recognized, they should be appreciated, and this is kind of a symbol of that as well. So let's go on to chapter 4 for a little bit, and then we'll close out for the day. Chapter 4, verse 1. Now when Sanballat heard that they were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, so you kind of have the idea where they're coming from here, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heap of rubbish and burn ones at that?" So you kind of see them saying, we've been here for the 70 years they've been gone, and they want to come back and be great again. Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him and said, "Yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up it, he will break down their stone wall." So they're saying it's garbage. "Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Don't cover their guilt and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, where the people had a mind to work." That's kind of the most famous thing from Nehemiah, right? Besides the scene later, I'll talk about when we get there. But we built the wall. The wall was joined together to half its height, so it was half done. For the people, or because the people, had a mind to work. They wanted to get the work done. This is always kind of a rally cry that we use. You know, we can get the work done that we need to get done if we have the mind for it. If we really want to get it done, we will. "But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites, those from Ashdod, heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion on it. And we prayed to our God and set a guard of protection against them day and night. And in Judah it was said, the strength of those who bear the burdens is failing. There is too much rubble. By ourselves we will not be able to rebuild the wall. And our enemy said, they will not know or see till we come among them and kill them and stop the work. At that time the Jews who lived near them came out from all directions and said to us 10 times, you must return to us. So in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, in open places, I stationed the people by their clans, with their swords, with their spears, and with their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your home. So, I mean, yeah. So you've got the enemies around them trying to fight them to stop them from rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. They send out reinforcements by ranks to kind of protect the workers. That's going to be a little bit further on in the text. You're going to have people that are building while they have their weapons in their hands. So they're trying to rebuild a wall, and they have to have swords in the other hand to be able to fight off people who are trying to attack them from doing it. So you kind of get the idea here that it's not an easy work to begin with, but having to fight off people while you're rebuilding a wall of a great city is a huge ordeal, but it got done. And so we're going to pause here for the day. Again, we are in Nehemiah chapter 4. We'll pick up in verse 15, Lord willing, next week. Hope you guys have enjoyed our study so far of Ezra and Nehemiah, and I'll see you guys on Sunday for worship, and then next Wednesday for our class.